This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 10 years ago today, Charlie Engel was out for a run, but not the kind of jog around the block you might be thinking about. He was running across the Sahara Desert. Charlie led a team for more than 4,000 miles from Senegal to the Egyptian pyramids. The adventure seems extreme to most observers, but for Charlie, the toughest challenge in his life is staying sober. He spent almost his 20s addicted to drugs and alcohol, found sobriety after a near-death experience. In his clean living, he renewed his passion for running, and that spirit has kept him sane in his darkest days, including his incarceration in federal prison for mortgage fraud. Oh, we've got stories to tell, and Charlie Engel will tell them to you, all of them and more. Running Man is the name of his latest book, and he joins me now. Charlie Engel, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
Let's start with that race through the Sahara 10 years ago today. Where were you?
Yeah, 10 years ago today, I am somewhere about 300 miles into Mauritania after having left Senegal, and where I am more specifically is some version of hell, actually, because we are 6 days into this run, and my team and I have fallen apart. I mean, this entire expedition that I've spent a couple of years working on is disintegrating because our bodies are disintegrating in 140-degree ground temperatures and logistical problems and bickering and just being out
in
the Sahara.
You sound surprised. Who gets through that thing?
Well, you know, I told my team before it started, in fact, that this is exactly what was going to happen because I'd been there before. And I knew that physically and particularly that there would be a deep dive into the abyss and that's what we were there for, in fact. And it was part of my job as expedition leader to keep everyone focused on the fact that we came there for a challenge. And, you know, had it been something that we knew we could do without a single doubt, then I don't think I would have been interested, and I don't think my teammates would have been either.
So I can imagine a 4,000-mile run across a desert in 100-plus degree temperatures. I can imagine there are a lot of challenges, but in particular, I mean, what are they? Because clearly you said you're prepared. So you're prepared for the heat. You're prepared for, I guess, the lack of water. How do you prepare? And what are the challenges? What are the things that actually caused you to, as you say, break down?
Sure. Well, back home, you know, during training and getting ready for all of this, you are in a moderately controlled environment, right? You know, I might go out for a 10-hour run, which seems extreme to people, but like I knew that's what I would be doing 10 or 12 or 14 hours every day in the Sahara. But here in North Carolina, you know, I could stop and get water. I could sit down and take a break. I could, you know, I wasn't going to get hit by a sandstorm, and I wasn't going to get lost, and I wasn't going to, you know, face a truckload of armed people who I didn't expect to come. Yeah. Although in North Carolina that could happen, but normally not.
Sadly, yes.
And you know, and so those things that happened in the real world and our real world out there were, while they weren't necessarily unexpected, it was about how did we deal with them. Yeah. And because we are sleep deprived and dehydrated and really struggling physically, when the physical part goes down, you know, it's like an old Muhammad Ali saying, you know, everybody's a champ until they get punched in the face. And so on like day three or four, we got punched in the face pretty hard. And it was a struggle to recover. That's though when I got happy. Like that's why I was there to hit that spot where, not that I wanted to quit, but that I knew, okay, now the battle's on now, and this is why I'm here. So suck it up and get my teammates pointed in the right direction, and let's just keep moving.
And
see what
did.
Happens.
You finish?
We did. It took 111 days, and we ran almost 2 marathons a day for that entire time, but we made it all the way to the Red Sea, and we survived that adventure, and I think we all got a lot out of it.
Well, we're going to talk more about what is that deep down self that you find when you get to rock bottom. That's a big part of your story, Charlie. But I want to see how we got there chronologically. Take us back to those days before you're running. You're born here in North Carolina. Your grandfather coached at UNC, right?
He did. He was the head cross country and track coach at Carolina for more than 40 years. So 20s into the 60s, and he had a lot of famous athletes, and he died when I was just a year old, so I didn't know him. But like what happens with a lot of kids, I grew up with this sort of mantra in my family of, oh, you know, you're like your grandfather, you're going to be a runner. And I think kids imprint on that kind of thing, and I certainly did, you know, and I always, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be a runner. And I had no idea what that meant.
Well, and were you? I mean, did you run?
I was. I ended up running in high school. I went to Pinecrest High School in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and I was a good runner in high school, but I did actually figure out that, at least at that time, the girls liked the football players better. So I of course, had to play football and some other sports, too, and I wish, of course, I live with very few regrets, but, you know, I probably should have focused more on running at that time. But I was a good runner, but I chose to go to school in Chapel Hill, and I wasn't going to run there. I didn't have that kind of talent.
Talk about your mom was active right here in Durham. She was a playwright and activist and had her own theater company, right?
She did. Yeah. She and my stepfather, Coke Ariel, who happens to live, we're about a block away from him right here where we're speaking. You know, they had a theater called the Pocket Theater, and I really grew up in this this atmosphere of theater and of, you know, protesting the Vietnam War, and my mom was very much a civil rights and gay rights activist, and she's still alive, but she has Alzheimer's, so she's in a facility these days. But mm-hmm. you know, my roots are just down the road from where we're sitting right now, and my wife and I have just moved back to Durham recently, so we're very happy to be back in this area.
I was gonna say, you went to Carolina, and of course, in your book, you talk about getting into football a little bit and JV basketball a mm-hmm. too, right? Yeah.
Well, Carolina was I went to Carolina with really great high school credentials, and I got there and was completely shocked that, you know, there wasn't a Welcome Charlie banner on the dorm outside. And I, you know, I figured out pretty quickly there were 4,000 other, you know, shiny freshmen that were also talented and smart and funny. And I got lost for a while. You know, the drinking age was still 18 back then, and I took full advantage of that, and my life took some directional choices that I didn't expect, but, you know, that's the way it was.
Well, tell us about those. You were at Carolina when you first used cocaine?
I was. You know, it was a couple of years after I got there, and certainly by no means an excuse, but in the 1980s, you know, cocaine was kind of the ubiquitous drug on college campuses, and I very casually was offered this drug a couple of times, and the first time wasn't much to it, and I wondered what the big deal was all about, and the second time, unfortunately, I found out, and as I like to say, I spent the next 10 years really chasing that high, mm-hmm. because it's never like that again, and unfortunately, it became a quest in a way, and something that nearly destroyed me.
Took you out of school eventually.
Absolutely.
So tell us what happened after you leave Carolina.
Yeah, so I left Carolina. I went to Seattle, where my dad was living. My dad and stepmother were out there. And, you know, I bounced around really for the next 10 years. And in the process I got married. And I was a binger, you know. So I was that guy that would disappear for a week at a time. And then I would come back remorseful and genuinely sorry and vowing to, that's the last time, you know, I'm never doing that again. And I would be the top salesman at the dealership or at whatever job I had. I was always the best at it. And I think it was not so much because I was great at those things as I felt this great desire to balance out this terrible person that I was on the other side. And I needed to have balance in order to have any self-esteem whatsoever.
Kind of proving to yourself that it wasn't getting in the way. Right?
Absolutely.
And were others beginning to notice that it was? What about the people around you?
Certainly. My friends, you know, and I figured it out at college even a little bit, where, you know, I was the guy who at 4 o'clock in the morning when my classmates would actually go to bed because they had a class the next day or they felt some responsibility to do the things they were there to do. You know, I was like by myself and up for two more days, and that behavior continued, and people noticed, but I was very good at what we call in recovery geographicals. You know, you move somewhere, you get the new job, you try to stay clean for a while, and you know, 6 months later, that starts going downhill and you're using and you get fired from the job and then you just move again and you start it all over again. And I had three or four of those in a row to California and Atlanta. And, you know, and I got married back then and I finally thought that might straighten me out. Didn't. And eventually,
you even had children.
I mean, and eventually I had my first son. Yeah. My first son, Brett, was really, really was the turning point for me. You know, I said, okay, I'm never going to use again while or drink while he's alive. And 2 months into his life, you know, I'm being shot at in Wichita, Kansas, you know, outside a crack house. And I sat there on the ground watching the police go through my vehicle. And, you know, like the police officer pulls out a little glass pipe from under the seat and he turns around and looks at me. And instead of thinking like, oh, my God, I'm in trouble, all I could think was, so that's where that was. And, you know, it's such sick, twisted thinking. And that really was the moment when I decided, like, this is a pretty good time to quit. And I went to an AA meeting that night and I put on my running shoes the next day. And that's what I did every single day for the next 3 years.
We'll find out where that led Charlie Engel when our conversation continues with him. His new book is called Running Man. He's going to read from the book in Durham this week and in Raleigh in December. We've got that information at our website. And our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest today, endurance athlete and native North Carolinian, Charlie Engel. His memoir is called Running Man. So we talked about the fact that you had made many, many promises to stop and addicted to alcohol and drugs. And there were many times when that was your last hit and you came back. But eventually you did turn it around and running became an important part of that. Tell us more about that story and that moment in your life.
Yeah, when I finally made the decision that I was going to take control, it was also all about giving up control. You know, I had to stop trying to micromanage everything, and I began to trust this recovery mantra of one day at a time, which everybody's heard, and it is cliche, but it is also it works. And I began to just simply focus on what I was going to do the next day, and that usually meant making sure that I made a recovery meeting and that I ran. I'll never forget the first run, you know, that next day after Wichita, you know, in Wichita, I put on my running shoes and I go out and I basically, you know, I threw up in the parking lot on the way out and in the bushes and, you know, on the way back and in the shower you know, it wasn't exactly a pleasant run, but there was also a part of me at that time in super early recovery where I felt it was penance in a way. Like I was not punishing myself, but I was allowing myself to feel like I deserved to be punished because I had quit 100 times before. That was always my joke. Quitting's easy. You know, I've done it 100 times.
Right.
And so why was this time going to be different? And the people around me didn't believe it. It's not that they didn't want to believe it, but why? All evidence, you know, was to the contrary. I had never been successful at quitting before. So I finally just had to, you know, stop talking about it and just do it. And slowly but surely, of course, time accumulated. And those first few years, I ran like a maniac. And people actually accused me or asked me, you know, didn't you just switch addictions? Because that's the easy answer from the outside. And for a while I said, you know, yes, maybe. But what I know is that drugs made me disappear and they made me basically hide and not be any part of who I am. And when I run, I feel so alive and so everything that I am. And so if that's addictive behavior, I'll take it.
Well, how did you come to it? Again, what part of that was conscious on your part, hey, if I start running, maybe that'll turn things around? Or was it coincidental? How did it happen?
It was a little coincidental, but I will say that I remembered, and in my book I do talk about this joyous feeling I had as a kid running around, you know, in my underwear around the yard in a thunderstorm here in Durham, North Carolina in the summer, and this beautiful feeling as a kid of just having pure joy. Like, that going out the screen door and just running because you're running. There was no purpose to it. And I knew that lived inside me somewhere, and I wanted to find that again. But I also worried that once I quit doing drugs and alcohol, that my life was going to be just incredibly boring and tedious. And I'll never forget, after getting sober, the first marathon that I towed the line, and I'm standing there, and I am scared out of my mind. Like, I'm like, I have no idea if I can do this. But I recognized in that moment even how much I loved that feeling. And I guess in a way, it's sort of like the drug life that I had before. You know, there was something very edgy and scary always in that life. And I found a little bit of that in marathon running.
You had the number of experiences you've had, both the extreme running, but even in marathons, the stories are incredible. Often humorous. You competed in one ultra marathon event that you thought was like a 5K.
Yeah, this one doesn't make me actually look all that bright. But I'm in Australia, and I have a business that I'm actually chasing hailstorms around the world, which is another entire story we won't go into. But it's for business. And I'm over there, and the first thing I learned after a few years, the first thing I do is I find a recovery meeting to go to, and the second thing I do is find a running group to run with. And so I'm running with this running group regularly, and I'm in Australia working, and I peel off the little sign. You know, this is way before the internet, in the mid-90s, and it's directions to a 5K for that weekend. And I drive to this 5K. I get there, I get my number pinned on, and I'm standing around a few minutes before the race, and people are talking about running 50K. And I'm like, what are you talking about? They're like, yeah, this is a 52K race. I'm like, where is that in the brochure? So I had managed to sign up for a 50-plus K race.
So that's more than a marathon. That's
32
miles,
right? Yeah,
so that
was 31 miles. Yeah. And to be honest, I was there already. Yeah. And I'm like, okay. And it was three loops around this course. And I'm like, all right, well, I was running marathons. So I'm like, I'll just do one loop. I'll do a third of the race. It's like 11 miles. I'll get in my car and I'll go home. And, I come around the first loop and the announcer's like going, hey, here comes the Yank. Here comes the Yank. He's in 10th place. I didn't know these guys could run. So now, of course, I'm like representing all of North America. I don't care. I'm quitting. Like, I'm done. And I literally, I start the next loop and head back to my car. And I get there and realize I don't have my car keys. And I'm like, okay, I'll do the second loop. And anyway, I end up doing all three loops and I win the race. And like by accident, I win this race. But what it taught me was that, there are gifts that come. And sometimes if you just stay the course, even if there was nothing heroic in what I did, because I actually didn't want to do it and I wanted to quit, but maybe ego or whatever kept me going. And it taught me, I never imagined running farther than a marathon. Like, why would anybody do that? And on that day, I figured out that I was equipped to do more than I thought. And I've really never looked back.
Was that when you decided to get into some of the ultramarathon events? Then?
It's exactly when. And I knew at that point I'd done like 30 marathons. And to be honest, I love marathons. And I loved them then. But I no longer stepped to the start line and thought, can I do this? Like, I actually knew at that point I could do it. And I missed that feeling of wondering. So in short order, in the next few years, I started doing races that were 100, 200, 300, 400 miles. And they were across the Amazon jungle and the Vietnam jungle and the Atacama Desert and the Gobi Desert. And I did genuinely every time I stepped to the line, I'm like, what was I thinking? This is such a bad idea. And then I recognized how much I needed that to continue to feel alive. And I also figured out that it actually didn't matter if I finished. Wow. Like, I did finish, and I won a lot of these races, but a couple of them I didn't. And they were brutal and awful, and I learned so much from those experiences. And I vowed to like, never pass up a challenge just because it was unlikely that I'd be successful.
Meanwhile, what's going on with your family in all of this? Because there's a lot of preparation, a lot of money. What's going on with them?
Yeah, it is. And I'm still doing this. So I'm chasing hailstorms. And luckily, I'm making really good money for like 6 months of the year and taking time to be home with the kids. I now have two boys. And my wife, Pam, is, she's very supportive of this new lifestyle, because the old lifestyle that when we got married was far worse. And And yet it did change. You know, I no longer needed, you know, the same things I needed when I was drinking and using drugs. And so I did start looking at this adventure lifestyle and saying, okay, how can I figure out how to make that my life, not just a hobby? And you know, and I was gone for long periods of time, and there were, you know, I look back at those times, and it's a mixed bag. You know, my kids are both in their 20s now, and they're very honest with me about how, you know, while they loved some of the things that I was doing and they were proud, they were kids, and what they probably would have preferred was just for dad to be home.
Well, it's a little self-centered, isn't it? I mean, 100%. You're learning, and so everybody can think, wow, if only I could get to the center of myself. On the other hand, there's people around you who, you know, aren't benefiting as much.
Right? Rightfully so. Rightfully so. People, friends even, would look and maybe not judge, but certainly question whether or not I was making the best decisions. And I freely admit that I'm an imperfect human being, as we all are, and that I was finding my way. And for me at the time, you know, I needed to continue to have that motivation. It wasn't like I was going, you know, when I was home, the nice thing about my job and when I wasn't racing, I mean, I was dad, you know, I was taking him to school and picking him up, and I was there, and then I was gone for longer periods of time. And now that they are adults, we do talk about it, and I think they, you know, my youngest son has just he's a senior at Carolina this year, and he's applied to the Peace Corps, and he's, you know, they both have these adventurous spirits that we all love to take credit for our, you know, the things our kids figure out how to do, but I think it did at least plant a seed that it's their job to live their own lives, and that even as an adult, I needed to continue to live mine, not just for them, but for, you know, for all of us.
I wonder what your thoughts are, though, on this need for adventure or this need for a thrill or a challenge. Because, again, if you get back to the centerpiece of most recovery programs, it is, many of them are about letting go. The problem was maybe the reason you became addicted was some fallacious belief that you could take control of things, and then when you couldn't, this substance then substituted. So let go and let God becomes a central piece of many of recovery programs. And I don't mean have you replaced one addiction with another, but is this a different kind of control that could lead you down the same path?
You know, I don't think so, and some of that is simply because I've gotten older. I mean, there is a mellowing that happens. I would also say, you know, I recently got married again a few years ago, and I happen to be with someone now, my wife Stacy, who on our second date, I'm describing to her the kind of things that I do, you know, running across the Sahara, you know, and all the things that have happened to me. And she literally looked at me with a smile on her face, and she said, okay, I can tell you've got this like suffering thing down. Like you are at your best when things are tough. But do you even have the first clue how to actually be happy? Like just be happy. And I very frankly looked at her and said, not really, you know, and I think the message too was maybe that she could help me with that. And I have found in these few years we've been together that I don't freak out. You know, I've had there's a big race I'm supposed to be doing coming up in the near future, and there's a logistical problem and I'm not going to be able to go. And I'm sort of like, you know, not the end of the world. There's another adventure later, and I don't have to do them all anymore.
Well, there's another interesting philosophical point that can be made on that point alone, the idea that maybe chasing happiness is a thing that's a fool's errand too, and that is precisely confronting our sorrow and being at the depth of our sorrow and grief that brings us to an ultimate kind of happiness that you will never sell on a TV ad.
Man, you did that in 10 seconds. That was fantastic. it takes me so much longer to say that, but it is this place where... Look, I love adventure, and what I love about it, going back to all the long races and the ones I still have planned, is they are so uncontrollable. I can't control the outcome. I can't control all the things that are going to go wrong. We all, including me, spend so much of our lives trying to prepare, whether it's an athletic event or family or business. You know, we only envision, okay, this is how it's going to go, and we rarely prepare for all the things that are going to go wrong. But that's what makes it fun. So these adventures, you know, that I go on, you know, that when you know, the car doesn't work anymore, that's the support vehicle, or there's a sandstorm and I get lost for 12 hours, or, you know, I can't eat for two, whatever happens, those are the things that actually help to form who I am. The hardship are the things that I know when I'm 90 and sitting on the, you know, in my rocking chair, hopefully. I won't be telling the stories of all the stuff that went right. I'm going to talk about all the things that went wrong, because they're the things that are formative.
One of them was your attempt to make a race run across the United States.
Yeah, and that went incredibly wrong. And I wanted to set a new record for the fastest run across the U.S. And to do that, I needed to run 70 miles a day, every day, for 45 consecutive days. I started this run in San Francisco, and I actually had MRSA. I had a terrible staph infection like 2 days before this run started. But there were sponsors. There was pressure. There was no not going. There was no delaying. I had to go. And I got 17 days into this thing, and I was managing my 70 miles, but I had gone to this place where I was only sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night.
How do you talk your doctors into letting you run with MRSA?
You have to choose your doctors wisely. So, you know, you talk to five doctors, and the four that tell you you're crazy and don't do it, you discount those. Well, and the thing is, you know, I couldn't take the antibiotics at that point, because there's no running 70 miles a day while taking a heavy course of antibiotics. So I had to try to rely on, and look, experience, I'd been doing this for a lot of years, and experience did tell me that bodies can heal from things even while you're putting them through great stress. Mm. And, you know, I wanted to see if I could do it. And I was unsuccessful during that run at the run part. But interestingly, what happened is I ended up visiting, you know, I was out there for this wonderful nonprofit. One of my partners was about these disabled children at schools across the country. And I'd been running so many miles and so many hours every day, I hadn't stopped at a single school in those first 17 days. And there was a second runner, a friend of mine, who was continuing to run. And I jumped on a bike and went the rest of the way across the country on a bike. But I stopped at like a dozen schools, and I talked to these auditoriums full of kids. And I did the thing that I was supposed to be there for anyway. And
do you feel that way? Do you feel sometimes that there's sort of, and I'm going to ask you this and see how you thought about it, whether or not you think there was some other purpose that you were called to do? Was it serendipity? Was there another calling out there? And the fact that it didn't turn out the way you wanted it to meant it was turned out the way it should have anyway.
Yes. And it was a crushing of my ego, quite frankly, because again, you know, just the year before, you know, I'd crossed the entire Sahara Desert. Matt Damon made a film about this run. You know, I got Hans Zimmer doing the score of this movie, running the Sahara, and it's this incredible experience. And, you know, a year or so later, I'm totally out of the run, 17 days into it, and I'm embarrassed because there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people watching. And, you know, and I was still at that place where a part of me thought that somehow, you know, I know they cared. But I learned at that point, or was reminded that, you know, I cared a whole lot more about it than all those people watching. You know, it wasn't going to change their lives if I did this. And I actually had a chance to show what I was made of when things went wrong. Because isn't that the other philosophical thing, is who we are when everything's going right shows very little about the true core of us.
Well, go ahead, finish.
Yeah, no, whereas who we are when it all goes to hell, that's what matters.
Well, and that's the person we never want to meet, and then that's the guy we end up running from.
Absolutely.
Which causes the greatest misery, running from that guy who's at the center of your heart.
Absolutely. And yet, we want to meet that person. I mean, in my opinion, I don't want to speak for anybody else, I want to meet that person. And to your point earlier, as I get older and continue on this path, the reason I don't stop, I'm not obsessed with it anymore, but the reason I don't stop is I actually know there are more things to learn. And when I was 35 doing these things, I was that person. I was the 35-year-old version of me discovering. I'm still discovering at 54, but I am different, and I actually want to see how, when things go incredibly wrong or right, it's not like I'm not wishing misery on myself all the time, but I but I want what misery has to offer.
Well, part of the experience is, isn't it, over those years that as you meet more and more of the self you've been hiding from, he's not such a bad guy after all.
No, and you know, when I was an addict, I get sober and I think, oh my God, I've got to take a knife. I've got to like slice this addict out of me. I need to get rid of that guy or I'm never going to have peace. And it took me a few years to figure out that that addict, you know, not using drugs and alcohol, but that addict part of my personality makes me good at stuff. It actually right. drives me. Sometimes it drives me crazy, but right. but it actually drives me to want to achieve things, and it does drive me to want to continue to learn and to grow and you know, in the end, be better, but also continue to fail at things.
I mean, you had to sit down and meet him and look him in the eye for that to become a productive and not a yeah. destructive character.
Yeah, and the beautiful part about running and any athletics is it is my mechanism to get there. You know, I know when I go run a 100-mile race, I have no doubt that at some point, it's impossible that at some point during running 100 miles that I'm not going to hate the fact that I'm out there and I'm going to want to quit. And that's the place I want to get to.
Charlie Engel has gotten there many, many times, and we'll hear about that and much, much more when my conversation continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with endurance athlete Charlie Engel. His memoir is called Running Man. He's going to make some readings around the area, and we've got those at our website, stateofthings.org. So we talked about this being the 10-year anniversary of your run across the Sahara, or at least the start of that run. After that attempt, you came back to Greensboro, and that was in 2010, and your life took a pretty dramatic turn.
It did indeed. So the second film, Running America, actually came out in Greensboro, and the premiere was on May the 19th, 2010. And on May, it was a great day. Friends, family, 300 people, just this, you know, again, a payoff. Even though Running America didn't go the way I wanted it, it was a payoff. The next day, I come back to my apartment after running some errands, and six armed federal agents came out of a coffee shop next door and slapped handcuffs on me and threw me in the back of a car and took me to jail.
Did you know what was happening?
I didn't have a clue. Had no idea what was going on, and I sat there in jail pretty much for the evening, still wondering that very same thing, and was ultimately handed a big fat stack of papers that was an indictment, a federal indictment, and most of it was in language that I couldn't even begin to comprehend, but the gist of it was that I was being charged with allegedly overstating my income on a home loan application.
Right. And this, of course, had been done widely in 2006, 2007, 2008. It's part of the, you know, what crashed the economy.
This loan was from 2006. And, yeah. and for this, apparently, I was being told that I would or could receive, you know, 20 years in prison.
Because you are being accused of misstating your income, which is, of course, what these, like Countrywide, was insisting that people do for, you know, pressuring people into making these. Now, the Countrywide guy, he doesn't go to jail for pressuring people into making these things. So you're, but the interesting thing is not only, and you signed this thing and you said you were making more than you did. So that's a lie and that's fraud. That turns out to be a crime.
Yeah, it actually didn't happen that way. But I try not to dwell too much on the details. But in fact, the loan application in my case was forged by the broker. And so I never saw it, never signed it, you know. And so it's an interesting thing where people very often say to me, you know, oh, you know, everybody was doing it and it was really unfair. And I'm like, yeah, everybody was doing it. You know, the irony is, of course, I wasn't doing it, which is an interesting thing. But, you know, but ultimately, you know, in a loan package, you know, that you sign with 150 pages and you sign where the red sticky notes are, there's a, you know, there's sort of a, when you sign that, you're sort of attesting to what's in it. And, you know, there was a loan application in there with misstated income, and you know, that was the genesis of it in a way.
Well, the genesis really comes before that, and that comes from a tax investigation that turned up nothing. So let's talk more about that, because the whole story is fascinating and how you got to that point.
Yeah, well, I do call it fascinating, too, and it would have been a lot more fascinating had it been someone else and I was reading about it. But it was me, and it was, you know, the investigation apparently started by an IRS agent who saw Running the Sahara, So interestingly, running this AR becomes this sort of linchpin in my life of really good things. And because I ended up fighting these charges and going to trial, I was entitled to discovery. And in that discovery, I received the grand jury testimony. And in short, he says that he wanted to see how a runner could afford to go run across the Sahara Desert. And, you know, I always say maybe he hadn't heard of Matt Damon at that point, because I certainly didn't pay for the adventure. But he goes on to say that he actually chooses his targets, by sometimes he'll just be riding down the road and he'll see somebody driving a car that he doesn't.
This is the IRS agent.
Yeah, he doesn't think that they belong in. And so he'll run their plates and pull their tax returns to see if they indeed should be affording that car. And if not, you know, he'll open investigation. And those are his words, not mine. I mean, they came in the grand jury that's how he was choosing people.
So he's doing the Sherlock Holmes thing, hoping to get a promotion. Maybe this is how you get promoted out, or who knows. But anyway, it doesn't turn out too well for him, for the IRS investigation. Turns out nothing there.
Yeah, well, after 700 hours of investigation, you know, my taxes were, I pay my taxes, and there was nothing there. And, you know, and he ended up, I'm not sure, I'll never know. But for whatever reason, it didn't drop at that point, and it continued. And he used the Patriot Act to basically read emails and listen in on phone calls and then dive in dumpsters and send in someone with a wire. And it was very, I knew none of this was going on, of course. And, you know, and ultimately it led him to one particular loan that I had that, you know, had misstated income on it, and that loan had gone into foreclosure. And ironically, not with a bank, though. It was, as you said, Countrywide, which many people don't understand, was not a bank. You know, they were what they called pretender lenders. They were they were not FDIC insured. And, you know, so it's even debatable whether, you know, there were no FDIC insured banks involved in this thing. So it felt like it was personal.
Well, the idea, I mean, there's an awful lot of money and time and expense. As you say, you went in, there was somebody with a wire who was recording your conversations, hundreds and hundreds of hours to get you, Angelo Mozzillo, doesn't go to jail. And we're told that, well, it's just too complicated to get those bankers, all the bankers who should be in jail and all the financial brokers who should be in jail. It's too expensive. But apparently, if you really put your mind to it, you can actually get a guy on bank fraud.
Well, and, you know, Angelo, I think he did have to pay like $41 million of the $300 million that he earned. So, right. And you know, and it's, look, I do look at it philosophically because, oddly, years of addiction and recovery from addiction and a lot of years of running made me uniquely equipped to handle this situation in a way. And I understood in 2010 that the government was looking for people to blame. And that's not a new circumstance. It's always been that way. I'm not even saying it is wrong, but I get it. You know, I get it, because people want somebody to be held responsible. And it was ironic that it was me, because I ultimately was the only borrower at that point in the U.S. that was being held accountable for, you know, the downfall of the U.S.
Charlie
economy.
Engel, the I'm man sorry, who crashed the economy there, right. in 2008. You we know, were wondering who it was. I thought it had to do with banks, but no,
sorry about
it
that,
was
but...
you. Anyway, you did end up spending 21 months in Beckley, right? Beckley, West Virginia, in a prison, a federal prison there.
I did.
And you ran in prison.
Well, you know, again, as I was saying, I think it was an interesting, I had a choice to make. After I was found guilty and I was sentenced to 21 months, I knew that I could continue fighting, and I did continue fighting. But I also understood, thanks in particular to one friend of mine who's an attorney, who basically clapped me on the shoulder and said, look, you're right about so many things, but you need to understand you're going to prison, and you should wrap your mind around it. And I arrived, and the very first day, it was Valentine's Day 2011, and I was very concerned about being someone's Valentine that day. And so that was sort of my main concern at the moment. But I got through that day, and, you know, I just started running. I started doing what I know how to do. And in recovery, we call it attraction rather than promotion. I started doing my thing, inmates actually, after a couple of months, started coming up to me and saying, hey, how can I run? How can I lose weight? Or how can I do this or that? And slowly but surely, I found my way through this very tangled web.
You were also preparing for another grueling race that you'd hope to do run when you got out.
I was, and Badwater is a well-known race, and it's termed the world's toughest foot race. It goes through Death Valley in the summer in July, every July, and it's 135 miles from the lowest place in the United States to near the top of Mount Whitney, and I love this race. I love the heat, 200-degree surface temperatures, and I actually decided that one of the ways that I would get through this experience was to actually run the race on the same day that they were running the race in California. I would run my version of Badwater around a quarter-mile dirt path.
I don't think the boredom alone would kill you.
You know what, though? It was a mental exercise. Yeah. And part of the reason I run, Frank, is to, as I've said, but I like to think of it this way, I want opportunities to literally scrape out my insides and replace it with something else. And I'm in this incredibly toxic place, you know, feeling sorry for myself occasionally. And I finally hit this point where I said to myself, you know, fair or unfair, just or unjust, this is where I am. And I have a choice. Anything from once I recognize that, my happiness in there and what I accomplished while I was there was completely up to me.
What about the inmates and guards? As you say, they were coming up to you asking for help, but are they thinking you're a little bit, you know, off your nut?
Yeah, they absolutely were. And I think that actually got me. You know, there were times when we were in lockdown and I quite literally would run for hours standing next to my cell. And I think it in my mind, I mean, here I was this white-collar criminal, moderately embarrassed by when someone would say, hey, what are you in for? Because that's what that's just a normal vernacular. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, I was accused of overstating my income. And they look at me like, what? I'm like, what? You know, one guy suggested that I get a tattoo of a fountain pen on my arm. It seemed really, I didn't do it, by the way. But, you know, no, and you know, I loved the fact that these guys wanted more. And how am I going to feel sorry for myself when, you know, the African-American guy next to me got 20 years for some minor drug offense? And my cellmate was 23-year-old white kid who got a 10-year sentence for buying a single bag of weed. And, you know, and that's just not a, you know, it's not a place where I couldn't go in there and go, yeah, but what about me? You know, because it allowed me to get out of myself and to have a chance to actually, I hope I did some good in there, but I also knew that that was my way through.
Well, while you were in there, you got a phone call from a white kid who was on his way to trouble. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so you're talking about my son.
My son
was, you know, my two kids had a tough time, you know, as can be expected. You can't parent from prison. Mm-hmm. People try. I watched a lot of guys drive themselves crazy trying to control their kids and their wives and their relationships from in there, and it's not possible. And my son was, you know, he was doing heroin. And the worst days that I had in there were those crushing days when I knew what he was doing, and I knew I was waiting for that call to tell me that, you know, he was dead or that, you know, something else tragic had happened. And my years of recovery, and as you said earlier, letting go and letting God, you know, I'm not a religious person, but the spirituality of the AA program allowed me to gain a level of acceptance in there that it helped me get through it. And I'm happy to say that my older son is healthy and happy and sober these days. And, you know, he's gotten his act together, and I'm incredibly proud of him. And it's so meaningful, but being in there and having to try to deal with that was nearly impossible.
There's also no AA in prison. What kind of recovery programs? In fact, you were leading a recovery program, but not the mainstream.
Yeah. So look, I mean, and I, you know, this is a complaint. I'll firmly say that, you know, it's a travesty that there's not formal addiction recovery in the federal prison system. state and local jails actually do a better job of allowing AA meetings to come in. But, you know, a guy can get a 20-year sentence for drugs in the federal system, and he may not get his first day of quote-unquote addiction treatment or education until he's like 17 years in. And that just shouldn't – that's not the way it should be. In this political season, it's one of the very few – it seems to be bipartisan things that we agree on is that far too many guys are in jail and women, you know, for nonviolent crimes. And there's more affordable, even if you're a tough on crime person, it doesn't make fiscal sense to put these people in prison for 10 or 15 or 20 years when there is a better way to do it.
So tell us about coming out now. You're preparing for Badwater. This is the thing you want to do when you come out. What happens?
Yeah, so I get out in August of 2012, and it's not going to be until the summer of the next year that I actually get to run Badwater. But I focus my attention on training for this 135-mile race. And several months before the race, I meet Stacy, who she doesn't know it yet, but she'll end up being my wife. And I actually, it's one of my favorite things. I invited her after only knowing her for a month. I invited her to be on my crew, my team for Badwater. And it was because it's such a raw event. The crew is there and they are there for every single mile. And so I wanted her to be able to see me suffer, if you will. I wanted her to see what it looked like with all of the other stuff scraped away, and I would get down to this core place. And so I do end up going to Death Valley the next summer, and I go out and I run this 135-mile race, and I actually set a new record for my age group by 3 hours, and I came in fifth overall in the race with a time of 26 hours and 15 minutes for 135 miles. And it really was it was reclaiming my life, and not reclaiming the life that I had, because that life was gone. You know, the financial things I had were gone. Those things were just gone. And I had to accept the fact that they were gone. And zeroing in on a goal like Badwater again allowed me to reclaim, if not control, some semblance of knowing that, okay, what happens from this point forward is up to me.
And what will happen? I've got about 30 seconds left. You're going to keep – how long are you going to
keep
doing
this? Man, I got no intention of stopping. So I'm running 100 miles next month from Jacksonville, Florida to Daytona. I'm running across Cuba in the spring, and my big – project is to go from the lowest point on earth, which is the Dead Sea in Israel, to the top of Mount Everest. And it's a pretty good metaphor for my life, I think. And I talk about it in Running Man, and that is this idea that we can all go from our lowest places to the highest points. You just got to keep moving.
Charlie Engel, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Charlie Engel, Durham resident, endurance athlete, author of the new memoir, Running Man, speaks at 7 o'clock Thursday at Regulator Bookshop in Durham, and on December 5th at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. We've got that information on our website. If you missed it, stateofthings.org. Program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director, North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.